Good evening. Welcome to the Conventional Sniper Podcast. I am your shooter tonight, Justin Coletti, and I have your spotter,
Anthony Sandoval.
Welcome back to the podcast, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
We haven't done one in a hot minute.
Yeah, it's been a little while.
Yeah, you've been busy hiding out in your hide site, AKA your house. So anyway, let's just knock out a quick, simple if, too brief. I want to apologize for the audio. I had some technical difficulties with General Bolduc. Had to do some editing before, but getting a little bit better on the microphone. And what it is, I think, so I've got two mics, but I've got a USB hub. And when I plug the mics into the USB hub, one of the mics shut off. So I think I just need a simple recorder, in theory. Anyway, if you don't mind helping me out, or helping us out, excuse me, I don't want to leave my spotter out of this, buddy, sorry. if you don't mind helping us out with some technical information on how to get two mics to work on my iPad, because that's what I record on. I use the Anchor app, and I record with the iPad so I can go mobile and bring the studio anywhere. So if you don't mind helping us out, some information would be great. So, yeah. Anyway, also, do not forget, I'm going to say it every podcast until April, the International Sniper Competition is going on. There is a day, this is at Fort Benning, there is a day for spectators. So if you'd like to come down, watch out, the most premier marksmen in the world compete against each other. That is the place to go. It's not Precision Rifle Series, it's not the Minuteman Rifle League, it's not Joe Blow's League down the street in Utah. It is the International Sniper Competition, the most premier snipers in the world. The world. They're going to be there all on one stage over a week-long competition. It's going to be intense. It's non-stop, basically, for a week. Sleep, never heard of it. It's going to happen. And it's also, it's during Infantry Week, so you've got the Best Mortar Competition and the Best Ranger Competition going on that week as well. So it's, if you were to put a Super Bowl date for the Infantry and Rangers, because I guess you don't have to be an infantryman to be in the Rangers. It's that week, which is the second full week in April is when it's going on. So, and yeah, hey, if you know, I don't like to toss cash towards things, but I mean, I do. Guns are cool, I guess. But if you're feeling generous, I know the holiday season's come up. The Army Sniper Association could always use some extra help. I know they're looking at doing some events around the year. We're going to be coordinating with them to do some events up in New England. So, just, you know, we're working on a website too. So hopefully we get the website up and running. We'll be able to put some dates up there. We may have some classes coming up. I don't want to give too much of a spoiler, but just stand by on the firing line. So look for some target indicators and we'll get you on. So anyway, so today on this podcast, we want to talk about the future of warfare as it pertains to snipers. And I guess everyone in general, literally in the future, at least in my prediction, and I don't know too much. If you can hear the fizzing, that's Sandoval literally drinking Coca-Cola right now. By the way, this is a sober podcast compared to the last one I did with Rob, which was drunken history. This is sober history, or sober future history, I guess. But, yeah, so future warfare, drones. Let's talk about Skynet, dude. Like, what do you think about Skynet? You think Skynet's... I mean, I know for a fact Skynet's going to be real, real soon.
Yeah, they need to stop with that whole AI thing.
Dude, I just did a double positive. That was cool.
That's how much you should worry about it.
Yeah, it's going to be a double positive with drones in the air, man. There's no more, like, let's just, hey, this outpost is out of ammunition. Let's go put up a bunch of LMTVs and 5-tons and drive this thing down the road.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, too, just think about what they do now in marketing. Just marketing. General scale, not even war involved. How they develop patterns of life.
Talking about business marketing, right?
Business marketing. How they, certain apps or cookies that you may have or you use, picks up your behavior patterns, stuff you were looking at, and the next thing you know, like, even these other things out there that you can command by voice that are listening to stuff,
and the
you
Alexas can have a conversation,
and the next thing you open your phone, and you're like, oh, I was just talking about that. So weird.
What's weird is when I talk about it in my head, when I say it in my head and I don't say it out loud, and then it shows up on my phone.
Yeah, that's even more.
That
weird.
Freaks me out.
Now we're going to go and kind of take this AI, because that's all it is. It's artificial intelligence. It's
right.
Learning systems and marketing that they use in business systems to develop these patterns so that way they know, you know, the trendy items to increase sales and whatnot. But that's besides the point. We're talking about
warfare. not really, because you're gonna use those exact same concepts in a more tactical sense.
Yes, just applied thinking about, okay, at I would say even at all levels of planning, strategic, specifically. I mean, you can take a look and be like, all right, man, here's the terrain. This is what I know the enemy's composition is,
or suspect his composition is.
Yeah, and then we're gonna apply some AI to it, and it's gonna give us our most probable answers. Like, hey, this is where they're gonna go. This is how they're gonna use their equipment. So, you know, think of it that way. You have something. This technology now is gonna be able to almost do everything for you. But as we know, I mean,
I feel like
that's gonna cost lots of money.
I feel like it's a real life Jumanji.
Yeah, real life Jumanji.
I hate to say it like that, because if you think about Jumanji, you know, Robin Williams, all of a sudden he pops up in the future, and there's all this craziness going on, right? But you've got the infantry, which is, there's a lag time between where the conventional infantry's at compared to other nations. And the lag times are different. But one thing every conventional army is not lagging right now is drones. I mean, ISIS has got freaking drones, dude. Yeah. They literally go down to the flea market, they pick up an RC plane, they attach a mechanical mechanism on there, and they drop 60mm mortars or hand grenades or IEDs that blow up. Literally, it hits the ground, sure. Boom.
I mean, the history since our time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they've defeated multi-million-dollar equipment with a couple of old mortar rounds and a freaking bicycle inner tube. Like,
yeah. You know, the first drone attack ever recorded in human history was done by the Americans. It was done by us. And I forget off the top of my head, I should have looked this up before to give you guys the exact thing. I'll look it up once we start going on the podcast. But it was one of the Pacific campaigns, or in the Pacific campaign, we took bombers, dive bombers, loaded the aircraft full of explosives, and made an RC connection to like a TBF Avenger. And a guy would be in a TBF Avenger, which is a torpedo bomber, and he would RC the other airplane into the enemy positions. And the Japanese thought that we were kamikazing them. That was technically the first use of a drone, except there's no camera systems in it. But it is RC planes have been around for how long? Those people have thought about using RC planes as drones forever. And I remember growing up as a kid, my grandfather would always go to the RC plane. There's huge clubs all over New England for RC planes.
Oh, definitely.
And they were all over the place. And what was more unique is my grandfather worked for Raytheon, and he was one of the lead designers for the radar system and the Patriot missile. I remember going as a kid to Raytheon, and there would be Scud missiles in the hallway. And they would literally drape, these were like top secret Scud missiles. They were dissecting them to figure out why they were so accurate compared to the multi-billion-dollar Patriot missiles that we had. And the reason why they're so accurate is they were using transistor vacuum tubes, where we reverse and try to like basically use satellite uplinks. And so the Russians, it's basically like a timed gizmo, you know, hey, go on this direction, and it shuts off and goes down, like the old V2 rockets, basically, right? Just go on, it's a gyro and a compass, it says go this direction, on this direction, we run out of fuel, and then it just drops. That's all it was. Same old World War II technology, but it had been perfected and was working so well that Raytheon was surprised when they dissected all the missiles to find transistor vacuum tubes still in there, which was using like the first computer system that was the size of a freaking high school gymnasium, you know? Like all that stuff was still being used and more accurate than what we have now. But I remember seeing all the stuff. My grandfather would go there and he goes, you know, I wish RC planes could be more of a brighter future. And I never thought to be like, yeah, let's just load that thing full of missiles and nuke someone with it. Like, no one's going to screw with me. And I, like, we had RC planes growing up in the house all the time. I flew them in the yard. I built them. I crashed them. I should have been a drone pilot by the time I was 5.
You would have had a lot more medals.
Dude, I would have had a lot more money. If I'd just been like, hey, Gramps, can we attach a camera to this? Some duct tape and put a more powerful motor on it? A spy on, you know, Mary Jane Rottencrotch next door in the pool? You know, my grandfather's a Korean War vet. He'd been like, that's a great idea, son. Let's do that. You know? But, yeah, if you look at the next, we'll say, for lack of a better term, conventional war, right? Because it's not going to be conventional in any means. It's going to be like World War I, where you have the old school thought of how war should be waged with, you know, everyone marches across the battlefield with a horse and they flank the enemy and draft through the front line. And then the machine gun, or the drone, is the equivalent to the machine gun.
I would definitely say that's it's a great lesson learned there. It's a good point to bring up because you're right. It was a lot of old school fighting, and I would say World War I was probably one of the largest technology advancements in the world, obviously, at that time. I mean, you had everything come out. You had airplanes used for combat, tanks.
Blimps. Frickin'.
And at the same time, you're still riding horses, into machine gun fire, and sending out carrier pigeons to send word.
Actually, I think there was two. If you watch the movie The Longest Day, they're still using carrier pigeons in World War II, and they use them on the beaches in Normandy to relay what positions are open with carrier pigeons. I remember there's a scene specifically in the movie where a guy launches a carrier pigeon up, and one goes one way and one goes the other way, and the guy's like, "How do they know which way to go? We're in the middle of a goddamn war." And all I can think about is every time I hear someone say, "Well, we're going to pop a drone up," I go, "What if I'm having a drone against myself? Like, what if I'm the sniper or I'm the scout guy, say, because you're a Cav Scout. What if I'm creating a screen line? Or if I'm creating, like, I guess a sniper can create a screen line, right? You can create a false screen where I'm out there, I stop their movement, I act as a delaying action, right? A defensive delaying action. What if I have a drone at 30,000 feet that can see me, but I can't see it? What if I need to go to an assembly area? Say I've got big battalions moving in the area, and before they launch an assault, I'm going to assemble at an assembly area, an alpha. There's assembly areas? No, man.
Yeah,
those things don't exist anymore. At least with drones.
I would definitely even say company-sized assembly areas are probably going to cease to exist as well.
I would say anything larger than platoon, platoon and larger. Like, you're more than two squads? Nah, dude. Unless you're spread out so much that they need a warhead for every guy, there's no way that you're going to be able to mask or move anything larger than 2.5 squads. We'll say anything more than 15 to 18 men without being hit.
Well, I mean, you got to think of it too. Even they have GPS-guided artillery rounds now.
That's true. I tested the 777, the Excalibur rounds in 09, which was made by Raytheon, and they were using laser-guided artillery to change the projectile in the flight, or change the flight trajectory of the projectile, you know, as it's coming onto target. Dude, the next war will be literally the two biggest things that are going to take and hold ground: drones, scouts, and snipers.
Yeah.
There's front lines will be held and gained by 1 to 3 man teams. And God, God forbid if you run into another 3-man team in close quarters, dude, it's going to be all out brawl. Hand grenades, fisticuffs, smashing dudes with rocks. Like, there's no, like, "Hey, let me call, you know, for the squad element. I'll pin him down over here." No, dude. Because all that's going to happen is you're going to run in that 3-man squad, and they're going to hit an SOS button. And then every SOS guy in the area is going to come to that one location, and there's going to be a drone somewhere that's instantly going to figure out his grid, lock onto him, and start searching and assessing. That's how Skynet's going to freaking destroy
anything and everything you think of possible is going to happen.
So the future of warfare is not this. The days of the big battalions outflanking cities or other big, like the Battle of Kursk, like tank on tank, huge open engagements across like flat tundra, forget about it. That does not exist. It will not exist in the future. You can't. The only way you're going to be able to do it is if you have a drone fleet covering you. That's it. So air superiority in the next war won't be with F-35s or A-10s or, you know, small Cessna airplanes with, like, the old bird dogs. I think they're the L-19s in Vietnam, where you'd have a bird dog in the air, like a smaller Piper Cessna Cub over the top of the battlefield, and he's just a forward controller for all the aircraft coming in the area because he can stay out and loiter around the area longer. Mm-hmm. And those aircraft would carry white phosphorus rockets. And as soon as the team would get in contact, they would give the grid or the direction where the enemy was. And once the fast movers, the jets, came in the area, the Piper Cub would, or the Cessna, would mark the target with white phosphorus rockets, like 2-inch white phosphorus rockets. And then the fast movers could light them up.
Hmm. That's also, I guess, how they control the elevators and stuff for, I guess, bombers. You know, obviously, your fast movers.
Yeah, you're always going to have aircraft direction or center, you know, center controller. It's going to be another aircraft controlling aircraft, because usually that dude controlling other aircraft understands aircraft. He's either a pilot himself or he's a grunt himself who understands aircraft. Because guess what the grunts are doing? Too busy fighting for their life to be able to control 5 aircraft from 10 to 30,000 feet. Now imagine, now you've got a drone. You've got drones stacked up from 10 to 30,000 feet, and those dudes are sitting in Las Vegas. Or better yet, now America becomes vulnerable to targets. Like, they can be targeted, because I can take a drone, and I can fly it from Siberia, and I can fly a drone over the United States and hit targets.
These are all very valid,
like,
things to think about.
Like, that's the only way that you're going to take and be able to, you're not going to be able to hold ground with massive elements. The Chinese have an old saying that one man with a rifle can stop 1,000 men.
Yeah, definitely say it. It's going to go down to squad movement for sure. That's going to be the one that's going to...
Actually, a couple of years ago, General Milley came out in his Eisenhower luncheon. I think it's a dinner. And he talked about how the future of combat is at the team level. It's going to be small groups of men moving around the battlefield. When they run into the enemy, it's going to be a fight to the death right then and there.
Well, I like those little LGOPs.
LGOPs?
Little groups of paratroopers.
You learned that out of a Toy Story, didn't you?
No. Straight out of the history books.
LGOPs?
Yeah. Normandy, man.
So, I mean, is this... Am I talking crazy here? Does this sound crazy? I mean, it sounds crazy,
no,
but...
I mean, you're talking about the future of warfare here, so like I said, pretty much anything's possible. I mean... And that's just only one aspect. We're just talking about drones. Just drones. Now you put all the other stuff into consideration. Guided munitions. Artificial intelligence, which can predict your movements, your probability of being certain places, or exploit vulnerabilities.
So how do you think the local civil? Let's say there's a kid right now. He's in high school. He's 16 years old. Right. He wants to join the army. He wants to be a sniper. How do you think that guy can mentally prepare himself to push the army into the next realm? How do you think that kid can make reconnaissance lethal again?
Well, I think that's there's multiple different ways that you know that's going to take for that to happen. But starting with the individual, I mean, one, knowing what he's getting ready to come into, obviously, and like you always tell people, like, if that's what you choose to do, that's your craft. You excel in it. You do everything you can to excel in that craft. So you have to know the job to be able to do anything else, right? So if you want to make improvements or try to innovate stuff, you have to know the foundations of it, where it's coming from, how to apply it, and then think outside the box. Okay, where am I lacking? Or as General Boldick put in your last podcast, he was able to identify his weaknesses. There's a lot of us that can't do that, which is very admirable. So that goes just not only with the individual, but within your team, within your scout section. Like, hey, what is our weakness? What do we lack at the most?
You know, I would say right now, it is technology's our weakness. Because I remember, and I'm sure you, when you came in the Army, they're like, go back to the basics. Forget electronics. Use the map and compass. Stop using all this electrical, you know, optics. Stop using your thermals. Start learning how to walk at night and let your eyes to adapt to things. Learn how to feel your environment, right? Walk in the woods without night vision on. You tell me how many times you smack your face across a stick.
Yeah, I've ran into a lot of banana spider fucking webs.
Well, I mean, think how do you think those dudes did it in World War II? How do you think they did it in World War I? What about Vietnam, where you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face, and you got to make 26,000 click movements, or, you know, 26 Ks, right, across the jungle without stepping on anything or blowing anyone up? We've got all this technology, but I guarantee you, we take a lot of dudes now and you take night vision away and say, all right, bro, there's an enemy sniper somewhere in here. There's an enemy front line, small groups of teams of three. You got to go over this 1,000-yard distance without getting caught or hurt.
I think it's important to be able to do both. One, if you can train without using technology, because I've been there where stuff has just not worked. Because, you know, it's
batteries die. Batteries. Weather affects batteries, like the cold.
Also, unfortunately, it is made by the lowest bidder.
I don't know. Some of the stuff you buy now is not cheap.
No, that is very true. I mean, there's a lot of guys, including myself, that I would buy stuff because, one, it made my way of life easier.
Mm-hmm.
and I wanted to have it for that just in case moment. Hey, guess what? I got this Garmin. I'm gonna turn that sucker on. Hey, there it is. It works.
Mm-hmm.
I got my grid. All right, we're back on track because my dagger just died, or something. You know.
Or it's in the middle of the night, and I don't want to take my red lens out to look at my map.
Yeah, there's that too. But I think if you're able to train to that, be able to exploit those vulnerabilities and train to it to kind of adapt to it a little bit, it'll also help you use your technology to your advantage.
Absolutely.
The way it's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be a combat enabler.
It really is.
Not the combat.
So.
Not the sole purpose or the sole thing you use in combat. It's, hey, I'm heading east. The sun doesn't look like it's east anymore. What's going on here? Check my compass. Oh, look at that. I'm going northeast. I got to change my direction a little bit. Oh, my compass is whacked it all weird. I don't know why. Let me take out my electronics and figure it out. That's what it's supposed to be for.
Yeah.
Example. I'll give you an example. So I went to the board to become a staff sergeant, right? And I just finished reading the book about the Desert Fox. Or not the Desert Fox, excuse me. The guys, the British SAS dudes, the Desert Rats, there we go. I knew it was Desert something. Desert Rats, right? And they're moving through the desert, and you can't navigate with a compass because there's no terrain features. It's just the desert. So how do you navigate?
The stars.
You use a sextant compass to navigate via stars like you're a ship, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about this, and I'm like, all right, well, they in the board, they want to know what's something you'd like to teach the battalion. I'm like, well, technology is eventually going to bite us in the ass if we go to Iraq. And what happens if all this technology fails? Because shit happens. And now, if I'm the enemy and I'm watching the Americans roll down a main MSR again back in Iraq, what do you think is going to happen? I'm going to start planting IEDs again. Well, if I'm so far away from something and I don't want to go on an MSR and my technology doesn't work and now I can't move across the desert because I don't know how to navigate via stars and I don't know how to navigate via the sextant compass, now what? My avenues of approach are predictable. I have to stay on an MSR or an ASR. So if I'm the enemy and I understand how maps look like, I can just take a map up and be like, all right, well, Americans are going to come across here, 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 here. That's it. Now my movements are predictable. But if I know how to navigate via the stars, and I know roughly how far the nearest city is, I can outflank my own MSRs and create an MSR. And then I can clear it all the way up and I can avoid minefields. Because at this point, there's no reason that I can't navigate day or night.
Yeah, very
true. I can never stop.
You also got to think, too, future warfare, the resupply. You need to think about logistics, too.
Mm-hmm.
How it's going to impact that. If everything's so vulnerable, what do you think resupply is going to look like?
It's not. The only way you're going to get a resupply is if you can get a grid out and a drone can get to you and drop your resupply off. Or you're going to have to resupply yourself on the move.
Yeah.
You're going to have to be knowledgeable of foreign weapons. You have to be knowledgeable with terrain. You have to study maps again. Like you're going through Normandy and you have to know the maps in the back of your head. You're going to have to understand how to survive on your own in the environment. What you can eat, what you can't eat. Because there's no, once you're at MREs, dude, there's no going back to the outpost.
Yeah.
It's whatever you can find and eat. So that is the future of warfare.
Valid point, though. I mean, I haven't had AA batteries in 3 months. What have you guys been doing? Well, we still fight at night.
Yeah. Like, I would say right now that local freedom fighters, or locum terrorists, if you want to call them, actually have a more, they have a better knowledge base because they're using all of this technology that doesn't require batteries. Iron sights, for God's sake. Iron sights don't require batteries. They don't. Now, I'll say we have the advantage with the ACOG, and that's why I think the ACOG, as of right now, does not need to go away. I know the Army's tried to replace it forever. It doesn't need to go away. I can chuck that thing off an MRAP, off a Humvee, and the glass is not going to break in that optic, and it's going to hold at zero, and it doesn't require batteries. And I can adjust the brightness levels in the optic. Mm-hmm. And I can call for fire on it, and I can use it as a battle drop compensator. And I can fire over the top of it in CQBs, or I can use them like canted backup iron sights. I can do all that. I don't need batteries. Like, I don't know why we keep trying to go to all this thermal stuff. Like,
no, I think there's
maybe some clip-on thermals to go through that, but once those batteries die, especially in like Arctic, like, do you think it's all gonna be warm everywhere we fight? Hell no. Shit's gonna like drain quickly, and I don't want to be like, all right, guys, hey, let's set up a patrol base here and plug in our batteries. No.
that's absolutely that's a very not, valid man. Point. I mean, we just did a we had tested some GoPros in the one of the chambers there at work, and we ended up having it was at like negative 60 or something. Those batteries lasted 10 minutes.
There's negative 60.
Yeah.
Why don't, if you don't mind, just briefly tell them like what you do.
So I am a human research volunteer program coordinator, as well as a equipment specialist for the Doriel Climatic Chambers at the Natick Soldier System Center. So I kind of have dual hat. Most of my stuff happens within this facility. So I do help sometimes set up some of the testing conditions that we can provide in our chamber specifically. I'm not going to talk about too much about it, but
let's just say that because I used to work there too, that you can replicate the coldest place on Earth and the hottest place on Earth.
Yeah, just about. With yeah. a lot of different variables too. Wind, rain, humidity. So it's very unique facility.
I think there's actually only two of this type of facility in the United States, and I think one of them is owned by Nike. I think. There's a civilian company that owns one of them.
There might be, but I know the only one in the Department of Defense is down at Eglin.
Oh, maybe there's two in the DOD. That's what I'm talking about. Anyway, continue.
But either way, it just showed that, you know, we're talking about technology here. I mean, it's still in its premature phase, but I mean, it doesn't mean it's not going to get there. And how fast can it get there? I mean, shoot, we went from, say, what, 2001, we had those, the first generation of PAS. It was like, actually not even World War I, 2001. I think it was Vietnam when they first started coming out with the first generation of thermal.
Of thermal?
Yeah.
Well, I know we were using night vision. It came out in World War II. I think the first version of night vision, I think, it was adapted for the M1 carbine, but I know they used some of it in World War II.
Like, I do know the PAS, Pacific campaign. The PAS time frame, late 90s, early 2000s, this thing was huge. It was like one of those old school, like, you know, like the tape recorders that actually took like the VCR tapes.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like the size of that. You're trying to put down your freaking, you know, your rifle. And you're like, man, this thing takes this humongous, like, gigantic block lithium battery that only the military made. Like, you can't just scavenge that thing.
So it costs us like $1 million a battery. Yeah.
So now, I mean, you just look at it now, we're down to a thermal optic that, one, is, I would say, 1,000 times better than what that thing could do.
Like, it's like the size of a pocket notebook.
It's not even the size of it. It's smaller than that. It's like the size, I mean, it's like
about the size of that Coke can.
Yeah.
About the size of a Coke can.
Probably weighs about the same, too.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
I know on the PVS-20s, you can go, I mean, I started getting issued them as a conventional guy in 2009, and we got infrared and thermal in there, and you could turn them on together at the same time, and that was like looking through Predator.
It was.
And you know what's crazy is that wasn't too long ago, dude, and we're talking about it like it's ancient dinosaur history.
I know.
Imagine, like I actually saw a photo. So I follow Ukraine, the Ukrainian Defense Force on Instagram, and there's a reason why I follow them. And when I first got out of the Army, I was selling suppressor sleeves, and I got brought on to work for a company. They're a good company. Their products they look interesting, but they serve their purpose. And I think a lot of the guys that buy their products don't understand that it doesn't need to look cool. It needs to get the job done. And for a guy who has a precision rifle, understanding that the future is my heat signature, because the drone at 30,000 feet is either going to go off of just a color screen, but more than likely he's going to be looking at the ground either white hot or black hot thermal, right?
I would agree with that.
And we know that most uniforms, or even if I put a tarp over me, I can hide from thermal, right? We know that for a fact because it screens my heat signature. But the only thing I can't really hide is the heat of my barrel or the heat of my suppressor. I can't hide those things.
It's too extreme.
Right, it's too extreme. Especially if I got a 240 machine gun, or even if I have a semi-auto M4, what people don't realize is that semi-auto guns, they heat up faster than full-auto guns because the gases are allowed to sit inside the barrel longer, and thus the heat tries to escape outside the barrel. Where versus when you're in full-auto, it's continually pushing the gases out of the barrel. It's not being stuck in there to soak into the metal. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So by pushing the full auto, though, will catch things on fire faster because as the gases are exiting the barrel, they're basically, there's like a little circulating cloud over the end of the barrel, essentially. And it's in fire science, it's the same thing when, and I'm sure you've seen the video where there's like a smoke inside the house. It's like a flash, it's a flash fire. And I open up the door and all of a sudden the house explodes in a fire. It's the same concept for when you run suppressors and suppressor sleeves on full auto, because the gases are cycling around outside and back into, where versus on semi-auto, you can go longer before things catch fire because they're allowed to go through the metal and it slows down like the reversion process, essentially. The fire wants to revert back to actually being a fire versus just being smoke or being extinguished. So, so I'm selling these suppressor sleeves and I get brought on, they're like, sell this to conventional army and all this heat protection and stuff. And I'm like, wait a second, heat protection? What's it look like under thermal? And so I take a look at it under thermal. I'm like, whoa, hold the horses, man. We need to sell this thing as infrared and thermal reduction, not heat protection. No one gives a shit about heat protection. I want to hide from the drones. How do I hide from the drones? Right? So I became like the Lord of War for a little bit, and I was selling suppressor sleeves to the Ukrainians. I was selling them commercially in Ukraine because I was like, well, wait a second here. How are dudes going to, like, it's really, I can't sell to the Ukrainian military because of ITAR restrictions. But what I can do is I can sell them to the equivalent of their Bass Pro Shop. And that means that dudes will figure it out and just go down there and buy them. I mean, they're like $40 in Ukraine. Eventually someone's going to figure it out and just go and do it. Right? And they'll be like, well, let's go test that out. Same exact thing that I did. So I was like, someone's going to be smart enough to do it. So I started selling to like Ukrainian Bass Pro Shops, and they were flying off the shelves. And I was like, aha, all right, we got some Lord of War going on here. I felt like the coolest dude ever. Go home the other day with a smile on my face, like, yeah, bro, I'm literally contributing to a proxy war and beating the Russians right now. And I don't even know what the fuck I'm doing. Like, this is awesome. So like, everything got my head spinning after that. I was like, how this peer-to-peer fight, small teams maneuvering out in close, tight areas, in mega cities, subterranean, right? And you're going to be hiding from drones all the time. And when you run into another squad, you're going to fight to the death right then and there, and that's how you take your ground. And I started studying up on the Battle of Stalingrad, specifically Vasily Zaitsev. And if you read his notes from the battle, it's exactly like that. Every square inch is, like, he created the sixes, where you've got two teams of three in like a semi-U, or, well, like a bowl, right? Mm-hmm. And those six dudes, or three teams of two, they literally create like a full 180-degree killing zone. Like everything within a 180-degree plane dies. But then when they have to move, or they get advanced on, they've got to go down to submachine guns and hand grenades. And they fight from one foxhole to the next foxhole. Oh, which, by the way, those foxholes, they're in a building. Or they're fighting from one intersection in a tunnel to the next intersection. Submachine guns, hand grenades, they're literally killing dudes hand-to-hand, taking out machine gun nests and pulling back because they can't push forward. And then compiled with all the modern technology of German bombers and artillery and Russian bombers and their artillery, it just literally makes a no man's land. So that's how combat will be. It'll be no man's land, fighting through rubble, hiding from drones in the subterranean area. Like subways, dude, you ever play Battlefield 4 or Battlefield 5 in a subway?
Yeah, it's complete chaos.
I hate to use video games on it, but, I mean, let's be honest. We have the virtual battle space and video game simulations in the military. That's exactly what it's going to be like, is that absolute chaos in that tunnel system, and you're going to lose entire groups of dudes there, like that.
The difference is you don't get to respawn.
Yeah, you're not going to get to respawn, dude. Like, imagine being a sniper now and having a bolt gun in subterranean warfare, fighting dudes with MG42s or whatever else. You literally play Battlefield 5 right now. It's exactly what the future, like, their map in the subterranean area in Battlefield 5. It's literally going to be like that. Some dude with a machine gun that has 1,300 rounds per minute, you're going to come around the corner and you're going to cease to exist. There's no, like, oh, look, I got a chance to fire my bolt-action 300 Win Mag back. That 300 Win Mag gun is going to be from skyscraper to skyscraper if you can get more than one shot off, because a drone is going to smack you in the mouth with a warhead. And if they want to do it quietly to continue to bait snipers in, they're going to use a warhead or a missile that doesn't have a warhead. And it's going to impact on you, go through two floors, and not explode. and there's going to be no explosive propellant in the warhead. It's just going to be a missile that comes in, slams through, and you're done. Because now they go, oh, huh, I guess they're up there doing something. Nothing blew up. They're good to go. And you're going to go up there and check on it. Guess what's going to happen to you? You're going to get a missile in the face. We already have that. We already have missiles right now that don't have explosive warheads in them, and they slam inside of vehicles, and they send a bunch of blades chopping around the inside of the vehicle and literally cut your body up like little pieces of onion, and it doesn't explode, and literally you just stop. I've seen two pictures of it, and I've talked to one guy about it that said that stuff exists, and we use them all the time. Like, why do we need explosives on warheads still? If I just smack it on your face, like a mat, and I just send out a bunch of little blades.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's also...
Think of how much cheaper it is, too, to manufacture missiles that don't have explosive warheads. Think of how many of those I can put up. Right now, it costs the United States military more money to shoot down a drone than it does for the enemy to replace a drone.
Yeah.
So, how do you think that's going to work? Or, better yet, when someone goes, I've had enough of this technology, I'm just going to EMP the area, and I'm going to put a bunch of drones overhead, I'm going to push my big force through.
Gonna have some designated skeet and trap shooting guys,
and,
man.
And your ACOG? And your ACOG is gonna be legit, because you're gonna be like, ah, you didn't take out my optic, assholes. And you didn't take my hands out, and my ammunition still works. That's how the future of warfare is. Not fighting, you know, this PsyOps Green Beret stuff.
No.
Don't get me wrong. Africa? Yeah. Definitely. But to a certain point. You know, and that... To kind of circle back around, that's why I follow Ukraine. They posted a picture of their drone. And their newest drone is a dual-engine prop airplane. And this thing looks like a PC-12 platypus plane with two wings, which I know you don't know what it is, but they fly over our house all the time. It's a stall aircraft, short takeoff and landing on improvised runways. And this thing looks sleek. It looks sexy. It's got these weird bent wings in there. And this thing has like the capability of carrying every missile ever known to mankind on it, including nukes. And this thing, I guess, has like a flight time of like 4 days.
That's impressive.
And it can do in mid-air refueling. It's only a matter of time before someone figures out how to rearm aircraft in the air. That's the next step. Because then you can have battle carriers full of missiles, right? And when you need to rearm a drone, the drone goes up there, it gets rearmed and drops back out of the aircraft. And we've been trying to do that since World War I with blimps. Airplane gets hooked onto it. The guy gets reloaded with ammunition, he unhooks and just falls down, and the airplane takes back off again. There's actually training footage from the Navy doing it, and that's how they would practice launching and recovering airplanes from a blimp.
We also made boats out of ice and sawdust.
That's true, yeah, we did try to do that. I mean, that's smart. Let's just blow up a bunch of ice and float it in the middle of the water, and then it won't melt forever. And now we have a big airfield.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me.
I remember they call that stuff.
I remember it was a special... It got abandoned because it was too large. What the space that they needed in order... I mean, now it would probably only take a couple of days to get it going, but I forget what it's called. You're looking it up right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so... imagine now you're a civilian competitor. You know, how can you, you know, prepare for the next one? You're going to get stuck in...
Pycrete.
What is it?
Pycrete.
Pycrete?
Mm-hmm.
Like, spell it.
Pykrete. Sure. Basically a frozen ice alloy. Made from sawdust and ice.
A frozen ice alloy? So it's like metal?
Yeah, it has some unusual properties, including a relatively slow melting rate due to its low thermal conductivity.
Hmm.
As well as vastly improved strength and toughness compared to ordinary ice.
I wonder if I can take that same chemical compound and mix it into a thread so I could cool my uniform.
It has to stay cold.
Well, isn't there a certain chemical that heat reacting with the chemical makes that chemical cold?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I'm no chemist.
I mean, they got race fuels out there that do that, too.
Well, why can't I take that same chemical compound and mix it into a uniform like a bug spray, and thus it cools the uniform?
Why have we not also been able to mimic spider silk?
Well, Natick tried that, and what happened?
every
let's tell the story about that one. That's a good
every
funny
fall
one.
We got some some pretty gnarly looking spiders.
Well, talk about it.
Well,
I'm pretty sure, well, for those of you listening, I'm pretty sure this is where Spider-Man came from.
Yeah, so this is what the rumor is that Natick, back in the day, was trying to figure out a way to mimic spider silk and its amazing strength and flexibility. So they had these hybrid spiders that they kept there that they had, rumor had, that they just let loose. And I can tell you, Justin and I being stationed there for a couple of years is about what, every late spring?
Like May.
Yeah.
April, May.
Around the barracks there, the building we worked in, there's these crazy spider webs, and these suckers would get inside the building. We'd walk in through the top stairs in the barracks, and these things would just start rappelling out of the ceiling at you. And you're like, dude, what is that?
They're like thousands of spiders.
Yeah.
It'd literally be like every basic girl's nightmare to walk through, and literally, it's literally like a whole, like, colony of spiders. I've never seen a colony of spiders, but it's like our barracks are colonies upon colonies.
Yeah, it was definitely weird. I've never seen spiders like that before. I tried looking them up too, and I couldn't find them. It's like, it kind of looks like a banana spider slash brown recluse.
Slash daddy long legs.
Yeah, wolf spider thing. It's pretty.
It's literally like Spider-Man got angry and had PTSD and then exploded like the Hulk.
Yeah, so, you know, my hopes of working there at Natick as a soldier. I was like, man, I get to be Captain America? Awesome. Well, I get to be Spider-Man? Awesome.
And then Natick's like,
oh, guess like, what? Hey. And Iron Man? That didn't happen either.
When I got there, there was a guy that had seen the basics of the Iron Man suit. And it was the Revision, the company Revision, like they make the sunglasses.
Yeah,
they had taken it over.
No, yeah, I mean we still do some. I mean testing.
We've seen the
different components of it there. I know we recently with our volunteers have done quite a bit of the exo boot portion of it.
Well, that's legit.
Yeah, from what I'm told, yeah, they said it's kind of just basically helps you walk, which I don't really.
Do they know how bad my back is and I could really use a set of those?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for a bionic spine, man. That would replace my world. I'd go back to service right now.
Yeah, seriously. 100% disability, never heard of it.
Yeah.
But, no, I think that's, again, that's going to be the future of warfare, man. I mean, it's going to go back to the World War One standards. You're going to have to reinvent everything.
Yeah, times 10.
Times 10. Everything's going to be counter-electronic. And I know there are guys that are using GPSs. They're using night vision that connect via Bluetooth. I don't know if you knew about this, but there's a Bluetooth system that connects from night vision to like an optic.
Yeah.
Or your optic connects to the Bluetooth, or your night vision via Bluetooth. So you can not have to even put your weapon up like up on your cheek. You can just fire it from the hip basically, mm-hmm. or whatever it is, and you can see where you're aiming in your optics. But that Bluetooth link, that's not passive. It's not a passive frequency. It can still be picked up on a scanner.
Yes.
So, realistically, as cool as that is, as long as you're not going against anyone that has anything to do with scanning, don't use that crap.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you got to think of it too, how long that technology's been in. I mean, they were trying to, I think that first started when they were trying to develop a device they could shoot around corners or something.
I think that's been, like, late 90s.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think of it now. There are a couple of times that we went down the TESOAs,
which is
technology support observation and analysis, I think it's what it stands for. I could totally be wrong.
Explain what a TESOA is.
Basically what they do is they have a Blue Force team, a white cell, which does basically gathers data, then they have an Op4, a red cell team that tries to fight against this new technology that's coming out, so it's still in its premature stage. But I'm going to tell you, there's some pretty impressive stuff that's out there that was kind of like, whoa. One, I remember we were at an event in Utah, and they were basically using Wi-Fi mapping. They're using Wi-Fi frequency to map out a building. Kind of like an internal radar, in a sense, right?
Yeah. Like these, the Call of Duty thing where it scans the building and you can kind of like see through the walls and gives you a blueprint?
I would say more of like, hey, this thing sends out this signal and everything. Obviously, the signal bounces back And so you can see the walls and you can see anything that's moving that's also bouncing the signal off. Because I can tell you when I was in the Red Fort or the Red Cell team and we were fighting against Border Patrol's BORTAC, which I'm not sure if many of you know, they have a tactical team, which is like Department of Homeland Security's Special Operations Force. They have BORSTAR as well, which focuses more on police and search and rescue. BORTAC is more of like, they're the guys that take out the...
they're the operators.
Yeah, they're no joke. They can't, they're good at what they do. But they knew exactly where we were. It didn't matter. I mean, I was in this warehouse too that fabricated livestock equipment like fencing and you name it. There's all kinds of machines, stacks of steels everywhere, all these little nooks and crannies that you could hide in. It didn't matter. They knew exactly right where we were.
So that takes CQB to the whole level of safe.
Yeah,
because let's say you're in a square building. We'll just say it's a simple square building. You're tucked up against the back wall, and you're watching the front door of the machine gun, and you're like, yeah, dude's gonna come through the front door. Well, I do a Wi-Fi scan of the building because you're talking about using the Wi-Fi. It's already in the building. Use the internal Wi-Fi, not like you just send out a Wi-Fi signal like a radio.
Yeah, so that's where I was at in this premature phase. Is there were sensors that were already in place that sent the signal out.
So, right. So let's say I go to a guy's house, right, and he's got Wi-Fi at his house. I just take his Wi-Fi signal, and that signal in a program basically creates the 3D footprint or the blueprints for the building.
I would say that's probably where that technology is going to head, if you got to think about it, yeah.
But now let's say I'm in the back corner of a room. I don't need to go through the front door if I know where you're at. I can literally go to the back corner, put a bunch of C4 on the door, or not the door, but the wall, blow out the wall and you behind it. And now there's no need to go in the building because everyone else is dead, including you, because I know exactly where all your dudes are at. Or I can pull back and be like, hey, put a warhead through this building. Not clearing it. 10 dudes in this building.
Well, I could also say they use the distraction devices very well. They don't move 5 feet without throwing a flashbang. I was on the receiving end quite a few
times. I was like, just by the look on your face, you've got your bell rung by those a bit.
Yeah. Well, luckily they were the single banger, so it didn't hurt too bad. You know, you can take them repeatedly. But if they were chucking the 9 bangers, man, yeah, it would have been game over. So I remember every single door or entryway we had into this freaking complex, man, we were trying to get crafty, you know? We were trying to think, like, asymmetric. Like, all right, man, we're going to tie this. We had these, they're basically made for, like, airsoft or something, CO2-powered, like, plastic hand grenade things. Mm-hmm. Like, man, we had set up so many traps. Didn't matter, dude. They got through every single one of them. Like, man, that's pretty impressive. That's why I said these guys know what they're doing. They're very well trained because, I mean, if you didn't have any basic knowledge of how to enter a building at all or how to search or any type for any booby trap, there would have been a few that would have got a lot of people. And they got through them. And they're very deceiving, too, on kind of like how they imply their tactics. I would say they did it very well. They had Overwatch with long gun guys. So... if they can see inside.
So they're covering all their bases. They're not just going to go in guns blazing.
No, so
very.
If you can move freely in this building, you're getting hit by a sniper. And that's before before they're even breaching. They see movement, it's gone. And you think they're going to go one way? Well, guess what? They're coming in the other guy. And they come in heavy, too. Their teams are like 20 guys deep. Then they split, kind of like what you're saying. I wouldn't say two-man teams. They do more of like a three-man kind of splits. Not to like throw their tactics out, but at least that's what they're doing on us. And kind of like how they went through this warehouse, it was very impressive. Because I remember going through two different places in Iraq, and we were just, winging it, man. And these dudes made us look like fools every time. And like, wow, being on the asymmetric side was kind of...
interesting. So if you kind of think about that asymmetric going forward into future, how do you think you can take, or how do you think, what are some World War One tactics you could possibly employ? Well, I can tell you one, asymmetrically, is a runner. A runner is asymmetric now. Literally taking a guy and be like, hey, I cannot send out an electronic signal on radio. I need you to run all the way back to battalion headquarters, delay this message. Go. Yeah. Now that's asymmetric.
Yeah, definitely.
It's so old school. It's like using floppy disks. Like, our nukes are run off of floppy disks.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that. I think it was on the History Channel or Discovery Channel a while ago.
You mean the save button?
Yeah. Yeah. It's literally on a floppy disk.
You got a 3D printed save button.
Yeah. So it cool. can't, you know, act. Well, there's two parts you brought up, or two points. So, asymmetric portion, using a runner is going to be asymmetric. And that's huge for reconnaissance dudes and snipers because their job, at least sniper wise, is, you know, engaging key targets and targets of opportunity at long range. But the other part is the collection of real-time battlefield intelligence.
Yes.
In your KIMS games, drawing on paper, drawing things in your mind, taking a mental picture of stuff, that's huge because you may not be able to translate that through electronic means. You have to verbally communicate it to the next guy who needs to take that message and convey it to the right guy, possibly, right? So as much as, like, technology is great, the runner can't be fast. The runner has to be accurate.
Yeah.
You know, that's a serious old school World War One train of thought. Doesn't, like, everyone think, all right, I'm going to pick the fastest runner in the platoon, and he's going to be the messenger. He's going to be the runner because he's the fastest dude. He's got the fastest run times, right? Mm-mm. You pick the dude who can relay the message the most accurately. That's the guy you want to go because no matter how fast a message gets there, if it doesn't get there the right way, it's not a message. It doesn't matter. So the guy who can relay it the most accurately is the fastest runner. And if you're a company commander right now, and you're like, or you're a sniper reconnaissance leader, or you're a sniper section leader, and you're like, how do I train my dudes to, how can I think about the next future fight? Well, toss in, you know, when you go to your next stick lanes, or battalion stick lanes, and I'm going to put my snipers out there, everyone's like, yeah, I'm just going to put a sniper out there, and they're going to report up your radio. What if you don't have a radio? If there's no way that your commander is going to trust you if you're just constantly throwing stuff up over the radio. Because, as General Milley said, eventually you're going to have to ignore those orders, and you're going to have to do what you think is right, because your commo is down. So do yourself a favor and plan into your training a time when commo is down, and practice ignoring those orders, and be like, hey, sir, here's what I want to do. I want to create this contingency and let us train it in this environment, because that's what training's for. Training is supposed to replicate battlefield conditions. If my technology doesn't work, what do I do? A perfect example of this in modern times is the fact that the Taliban can hide out in a cave with their dingo cell phones and make cell phone calls, but me with my $50 billion Harris radio on TACSAT can't make a call across the next ridgeline, but the dude in the cave that is so far in there that our bunker busters can't get next to it, he can call some dude in Pakistan and ask for help. Like, there's an issue here. There's a discrepancy, and the discrepancy that can, the materials, the training solution to this material problem is literally word of mouth. Yeah. Word of mouth cannot be hacked. It can't be traced unless you get rolled up.
But definitely, I would throw this out there too. The other aspect of asymmetric, being able to fight an asymmetric fight, is also training for the asymmetric fight.
Right.
And what you're saying is material solutions can't always be the answer. And this goes specifically, there's a lot of things that the Army, or I'd say the military, does specifically that actually hurts itself quite a bit. And I'm just going to run a scenario to you, right?
Okay.
If I give you a task, like, say, you know, this is, you're in a semi-permissive environment.
Which is, can you break that down? What is that?
So there could be an enemy threat, all right, okay, in the area. So
I know what it is, but someone listening might not.
So it's on your discretion whether you're going to wear body armor or not, or what your loadout's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You can go light, just the essentials. Wear the full battle rattle.
Look like, know, a SWAT dude going in with a shield.
Yeah. Now here's a scenario, right? And this is fabricated to prove a point. I need you to exfil somebody, right? Say I got this tower, like a rappelling tower that we used to have.
So 10 floors.
So yeah, about 10 floors. There's a second story window in one of them. Your guys and you can only get access into this tower through the second story window. How are you going to do it?
How many guys do I have?
A squad.
Who's the tallest guy?
Doesn't matter, right? You have a tall guy.
Okay. So 6'4"?
Sure.
Okay, I got to do the 6'4". And I got to get in the second story window? Well, I put 6'4" and 6 together, and that's the second story window. and now I can get up there.
You use these guys as a ladder, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that would be the fastest way to do it, because if not, I could use a material equipment solution to it. But if I'm like, hey, you're packing light, get your shit up there. Let's go. You on top of his shoulders. You get up there, we'll worry about getting stuff down. We're getting more dudes up there.
Okay.
Because I just need to get
in there.
I want
you to think about this. It's still a semi-permissive environment, which means there could be a threat. All right?
Fine. I don't. I knocked down the whole tower.
You guys are all standing outside this tower, trying to get the whole squad inside the second story window.
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing this with your kit on? Or are you going to take the kit off and get your butt in the window and then put the kit back on?
Well, it depends if you want me to say it. Like,
well, I'm
going to
tell you what the Institute answer is more than likely going to be.
Do you want me to tell you what my stupid answer would be?
I'm just gonna throw this out there, right?
Let me say
this.
My
this is a real story that happened to me.
I'm gonna figure out who I don't like the most to tell them to put their kit on and go out there and find out there's a dude in there.
When I was going through the Asymmetric Warfare course, Adaptive Leaders Program, with Asymmetric Warfare group down at AP Hill. So I was in this exact same scenario, right? We're sitting there with battle rattle on, trying to get in the second story window, and one of the instructors comes over. This old guy, I can't remember his name. He was a former Delta boy for sure. He pulled us all aside. He's like, "What the heck are you guys doing? Like, getting in this window?" Like, yeah. Well, what'd I tell you guys 2 days ago? And so the way this course was designed is, some of us went to a specific training, and we're all thinking like, "Okay, I went to this training this day. I'm gonna go to this training the next day." That's not what they did. They threw one person from each different training together in one team, and it was our job to develop that mental pathway and bring that knowledge to the team and fight. Well, part of one of those trainings was a climbing course, and obviously it makes a lot more sense to take off 50 pounds of the lightest stuff ever made, get your butt in the window, and put it back on.
50 pounds of the lightest stuff ever made, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, just throwing a number out there. Instead of struggling outside of this window with body armor on and everything else, trying to get lifted up into this window and climb through there, your exposure time was extravagant, but what's your number one thought?
Get in the window.
Some sergeant major somewhere is going to snipe me if I take my kit off. Just come out there and I'm going to get yelled at. Right?
Yep.
And it just goes, there's a lot of things that we do training-wise, and there's a different example. Part of this other scenario, we only hoist the casualty through the six-story window. Well, we had the ropes, we had everything else, and we had pulleys, and we're yanking this freaking, like, 200-pound mannequin up six stories out of this medical halo we made out of rope. We had a Humvee. And the guy was like, why don't you just tie the rope to the Humvee, drive it, have the thing lift it up for you, and then get your guy in the window. I'm like, what? You can do that? Yeah, you can do that, but there's things that's so instituted in training for being safety that it actually hurts us over the long run. Then it goes back to standard marksmanship. 23 out of 40 targets, it's less than 60% is failing. And we say that's okay.
Dude, there's nowhere in the world that you're going to take a test that it's acceptable to pass with anything less than 70%. You know? Like, the high school I went to here in New Hampshire, anything below 70% was failing. You go to most other high schools, it's a 59.
And we're talking about general standard across the Army. Doesn't matter if you're an infantry guy or you're a supply dude. 23 out of 40 targets go. Now, should it matter to those guys that, like, okay, you can only hit 70% of the targets? My main job is to sit behind this desk and order paper. Gotcha.
But here's the thing: not in the future war. There's no sitting behind a desk, dude.
But we're also saying this is the problem with General Sanders too, across the board as well. Is this is your job? Standard infantry guy, and we're still accepting in 23 out of 40.
You shouldn't get anything below maybe.
So I know
like a 38 or 39.
They're changing the marksmanship standards and all that stuff going out there. I haven't personally seen what they are. I'm retired. I mean
we can go over it. It's Googleable. You can Google
is.
It. So maybe we'll go over it in a future podcast.
So that's definitely something we could do later on. Just to throw that out there, sometimes you got to think outside the box and think about stuff that you do that's instituted. That you're thinking about it, that actually hurts. Thinking outside the box and training towards this asymmetric, technology-driven future we're heading to.
And, you know, that brings up a good point, because logistically, I kind of want to circle back around again. We've circled back around like 5 times at this point, but logistically, imagine if you didn't have all of that stuff with you, or you had to get the dude up to the sixth floor, and you, like, you need to get new equipment. Like, what about 3D printing stuff in the field? Where are you going to get, where are you going to be able to resupply yourself? You know?
You know, that's a very innovative idea, but it also goes back to the same point. Well, if you can't even get a drone out there with a speed bag, how are you going to be able to haul around a 3D printer?
It's true. You know,
so it's still, but you got to think of just general things that you can make there at probably the one place you would normally bring supplies into, right? That stuff's getting manufactured overseas. So instead of having to manufacture over there and have to wait this much longer for it to arrive, we could do it here. So,
yeah.
Could it change stuff? Could it actually get stuff out faster? Sure, why not?
You know, in one of the shooting matches I went to this year, or I guess now, at this point, last year, it was the New England Precision Rifle Series match. And they had a stage on there that you were not allowed to use any of your tripods. But you had 3-6 and a bungee cord, and you had to make your own tripod. And I was like, oh, hey, I can make a tripod. So I set up my tripod with it, and I shoot, and I do well on the stage. And after, I was like, why do they have that stage here? There's a point to this stage that is broader than what I'm actually seeing. Besides the fact that, hey, we're tired of everyone having their stupid $1,200 tripods, just shoot the goddamn gun and have fun. Like, I understand the point socially of that stage, mm-hmm. right? Because everyone tries to game it by having the latest, greatest, you know, carbon fiber tripod and all this stuff, but I guarantee you sticks weigh less than tripod. It's 3 sticks and a bungee cord weigh way the hell less than a tripod with a ball head. Guaranteed.
And it's field expedient. Just like when you're, I mean, you're talking about the TacFit antennas, and I remember going through Arslick, and literally a ball of comma wire worked better than those freaking antennas did.
What's Arslick?
Reconnaissance Surveillance Leaders Course.
I know about it, but so explain it.
Some say it's the fourth phase of Ranger School. I believe it focuses more on reconnaissance. A lot of it was kind of driven from the long-range reconnaissance and surveillance teams that the Army used to have that are kind of being redeveloped again, word of mouth. but
so Arslick may, or not Arslick, but LERP may come back?
It might. I definitely would, if we're going to be going to this type of fighting, I would definitely say it's going to come back. It was an asset.
Mm-hmm.
So, same thing.
Which LERP is long-range reconnaissance and patrolling.
Yes, so... and these guys, so you have different, like I said, we were talking about in a different podcast, we have different types of reconnaissance being done with specific objectives to be met. One is painting the picture of the battlefield, and one is maybe, you know, gathering intelligence on specific known areas, advance guard, you name it. But there's also more detailed, you'd send these guys in to, I would say this is more like pre-mission planning. Mm-hmm. To kind of gather and surveil that one specific thing you're trying to find out. In that sense, and that's the same thing goes with the Pathfinder guys, too. Going in, developing, like, hey, landing areas, like, is where you can drop dudes in, or setting up some landing zones. So, I think a lot of that stuff's going to come back, truthfully.
You know, some of the old equipment, it's going to come back, too. Like, we were talking about weapons cases earlier tonight, and like all these scabbards and high speed stuff, and you're like, you know, I'm like a 1940s rifle scabbard, 2 buttons and I pull the gun out.
Yeah, well, the I was actually talking about the they call it the 1950s weapons case.
Yeah,
really, it's a slide fastener or a zipper.
Slide fastener.
Yeah, and it's got at the very top, the zipper continues on the main portion of the pack, and then the actual flaps got shorter, so you basically just run the zipper through. And then you just pull the zipper portion apart, and you literally have your weapon out of this case in a second. Instead of having to undo these buckles or all these fast snappers, you know, the buttons and stuff, and making a ton of noise. It was very, very fast and very simple.
It's like the concealed weapons bags you can fit like your AR pistol in. It just has a big zipper on it, or whatever you call it, go fast stuff. The go faster.
Yeah, I mean, shoot, we used to stick. We had. You know, we used to stick saws in them, and then we had, once the 240s came out, the Bravos with the collapsible buttstock, and then we had the 240 Limas.
Big difference. Limas are nice.
Yeah.
A lot lighter.
We used to jump those suckers in, too, but Kind of going back to your, you know, what you're talking about when we were talking about Arslick, is they focus more on, I would say, hindsight development, hindsight, so underground, which was incredibly challenging in the middle of the night, digging a hole big enough to fit three dudes in, covering it up with wood and topsoil to make it look like nothing was ever disturbed, with this tiny little window with some mesh camouflage that we're surveilling. You know, we have a spotting scope or a huge camera with a lens on it, and we're taking pictures. And then we're taking these pictures, putting it on a tough book, labeling stuff, compressing the file, and then we're shooting this image over SATCOM.
Which is satellite communication.
Yeah. So, and they would receive it, and they were actually, it was very crude, but they would get a picture of stuff that was being observed, that was all labeled up as what we noticed or was able to determine what it was, and it was pretty cool. But you think about it now, you can do the same thing with a cell phone.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. So, a lot more old school technology. Part of it, too, was...
But, I mean, that's why that old school portion of pen and paper, dude, you can't go wrong with it.
Yeah.
The only thing you can do...
Sector sketches? Definitely got good at sector sketches. Yeah. And then the target identification portion of that course, I think we went over, like, it was something close to 200, something over 200 different weapons, as well as... like 300 different vehicles or something like that from across the world.
Imagine you would start being able to learn like enemy automated vehicles or unmanned vehicles now on the ground.
You're
start losing that stuff too.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a component too. And that was the thing, is we were able to not only identify it by the picture of, you know, different features it had on, but also identify it through thermal. So that was probably the most challenging portion of that section of the course. You're literally looking at a blob of white or black on white. You're like, oh, here's the exhaust fan over there.
And that's a BMP.
Yeah.
No candidate. Go ahead and retest.
Pretty much. You're
better at this lane. That is a Jeep. Shit.
Yeah.
That's an unmanned T2 terror drone with dual 20 mics on there. Yeah, you are dead at the station, candidate.
I mean, just like going back to your podcast about the technicals. Well, technicals have also... I've seen some Zeus 14s welded on the back of some of them Toyota pickups.
Yeah. There's like a whole Toyota technical tree, dude. You know, I saw a video today of... a picture. And it was... it was Bagram, you know, like Bagram just got attacked today or yesterday, technically yesterday now.
Yeah.
And it was a Toyota Land Cruiser 2-seater that had the top botched off and cut. And the Afghan National Army had like mounted like a 6 or 8 pod rocket tube on the back of this thing. And they were like dropping rockets, like the old school Russian Stalin, 18-wheeler, they used to call them the Stalin's organs in World War II, and the rockets would be dropped in from the top, and they would shoot out. I'm thinking about something different, not the trucks, but you would drop, like, a whole pack of rockets in the top, and they'd shoot off.
Kind of like the Screaming Mimes?
Not the Mimes. Well, the Mimes were a cylinder-based system, but kind of. There's one that has, like, you know, like the Bofors 40mm, where you drop the rounds in the top, like on a stripper clip?
Yeah.
There's one that's like that for rockets. Okay. And you drop the rockets in, and they're like 80mm like recoilless like mortar rockets. Basically, they have a big fat warhead on the top with a skinny tail, and then it spikes off with fins. And you drop them in the top like a stripper clip, and then as soon as the first one hits, it launches it out of the tube and then slides the next one in. Mm-hmm. And they're firing this thing out of this Land Cruiser, and the whole back of the vehicle from the motor ignition on the rocket is just on fire, and the back part of the vehicle is just straight black, and then the rest of it is like an OD green. And I'm thinking to myself, like, how do you not burn your seats? Like, the rocket motor has got to be burned, like singeing your seats. And I'm looking at the photo more, and sure enough, the seats are like, you know, like Afghans would put the see-through plastic over their seat so it never gets disturbed? Or it was like that, and I was like, is that... Does that dude have a straight-up clear plastic coating protector over the top of his seats and he's not catching it on fire? If the back of the the Land Cruiser's like singed black. I was like, wow, dude, that's impressive. I'm thoroughly impressed at your ingenuity. And I was like, I should have mentioned this in the podcast, but it's not a pickup truck, you know, can't talk about it. But they do have their own technical tree. Like I saw at a defense arms show, you know, I don't know, maybe a couple of years ago or something like that. They had had a Toyota pickup truck there, and it literally looked like the Iron Man Stark missile launcher was in the back of this thing. And it had like a joystick that was remote controlled, so you could turn the rocket tube 360 degrees and shoot at anything.
If you want to think about technology and technicals and asymmetric stuff, just look at some of the videos of the stuff ICE has created.
Seriously.
Like that. Remember that video? I mean, we were joking about one of our former counterparts who's on leave that we haven't
heard
for
a
while.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This guy's name is Bob. We're going to call him Bob for this podcast.
Sorry.
So we'll call him Bob.
Yeah, so there was a, it was basically, it's like a dump truck with a cannon, literally an old school cannonball.
Yeah, you can Google it. I think it's like ISIS cannonball truck, I think is what the name of the video is.
And I'm literally shooting an old, it looked like an old school cannon with like cinder blocks out of this thing.
It actually was, you can watch, you're right, it is a cannon. And it fires a cannonball, and the cannonball has no explosive properties. And it's literally just to be like a siege gun.
And
it just slams through buildings.
Stuff where they made mortar rounds out of propane tanks. And
oh, yeah, they fire the propane
tanks.
These
are just drones you can get at, like, I don't know, Walmart.
Well, they're equivalent to Walmart.
Yeah, they're equivalent. You know, that quality that they're strapping stuff to. And defeating an enabled force that has our technology. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, some of the IEDs that a lot of us have witnessed over the years definitely attest to the fact that some rudimentary things have destroyed a lot of money. And unfortunately, we've lost a lot of lives. And
over a $20 piece from China.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. You know, with that being said, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that we'll probably be doing some classes coming up this year in connection with the Army Sniper Association. I was actually talking to them yesterday about it, and it looks like it's going to go through. And maybe we'll put a stage on there where we'll teach you guys how to not use tripods, but use a tripod. We'll literally create sticks. You go gather them up. We're going to shoot out of it. We'll put a thing in there, like a competition at the end, once you learn everything. And it's field expedientness only. Whatever you find in a box that we give you is what you can use. And I think that would be extremely prevalent because now I don't need to go spend $1,200 on a beautiful carbon fiber tripod from Really Right Stuff. If I'm going on a hunting trip, I can literally bring a bungee cord with me. And I can go to wherever I'm at, find three sticks, and bungee cord my tripod. Now, you're going to be like, well, why would I want to go do that? Well, because every time you fly with an airlines, if you're anything over 50 pounds for your second bag, that's money out of your pocket. I don't know how many times I get charged extra money. I'm sorry, I got the dog in here. Apparently, she doesn't like being charged extra money. So, if you hear growling or stampeding in the mic, that's the dog upstairs. sorry, Mike's a little sensitive. But I get charged all the time for extra baggage fees. But no matter how much my carbon fiber tripod is, ounces equal pounds and pounds equal dollars when I travel in the civilian world. Luckily, I have a CAT card. I don't get charged depending on what airline I go to for bags because I'm a civilian now, but it still says Army on my ID card. But, like, dude, there's sometimes I'm $300 in overweight fees. And I'm like, dude, I just bought another airline ticket. Why didn't I just buy two tickets and get myself two bags? It would have been cheaper. You know? Hey, I'm Joe Snuffy checking in for Joe Snuffy. Checking in for Joe Snuffy again. You know? Like, I don't know why. You know, anyway, maybe we'll do that in the class and we'll find out some high-speed expedient stuff. Like, I know the old-school adage of just shooting out of a bag, but what if I don't want to shoot off a bag? What if I don't want to carry shooting sticks all the time? I just, literally, I'm up there, grab this stick, grab that stick, get some bungee cord, boom, done. Because if I've done my hunting and now I don't need to carry that gear back, I can leave my sticks there and bring my bungee cord back. I've just saved myself like 2 or 3 pounds.
Bunch cord or 550 cord.
Yeah, and I've saved myself 2 or 3 pounds. Because ounces equal pounds and pounds equal pain.
Sorry, the technical board. Type 3 nylon.
Yeah, dude, we're going to have to do a whole podcast on what the Army technically calls zippers and 550 cord and hook and loop fastener, a.k.a. Velcro.
Velcro.
Anyway, so thank you for listening to this podcast, guys. We're going to wrap it up. We're about an hour and 15 minutes, almost an hour 20 of this. For those of you that listened to the podcast before, Don Boldick, you know, as he said in the podcast, we're probably doing some more. The guy just has so much knowledge that I think are super important going forward in the political season, so to speak, and for our generation to be able to pass on that knowledge to the next generation. Because these types of wars, these never-ending wars, are going to continue on. It's going to be like this for the rest of our lives and our kids' lives. And might as well pick his brain while we can. You know?
Absolutely.
So, anyway, thanks for listening in. From the Tallgrass, one shot.
One kill.
Have a good night, guys.